How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach when feeling out of sight for the ends of being and ideal grace. I love thee to the level of every day's most quiet need by sun and candlelight. I love thee freely as men strive for right. I love thee purely as they turn from praise. I love with a passion put to use in my old griefs and with my childhood's faith. I love thee with a love I seem to lose with my lost saints. I love thee with the breath, smiles, tears of all my life. And, if God choose, I shall but love thee better after death. That's a famous love sonnet by Elizabeth Barrett Browning. Barrett Browning, Shakespeare, John Clare, George Meredith, and other writers from past centuries made great use of the 14-line form of the sonnet. But what about writers in modern times? Is the sonnet still alive? I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
This spring, a group of English professors at the UW-Madison decided to illustrate the history of English literature by surveying six representative sonnets from the Renaissance to the 21st century. In our last hour, we explored sonnets from the Renaissance, Romantic, and Victorian periods. Today, we continue our conversation on sonnets with a look at modern and contemporary examples. Professor Caroline Levine will introduce the hour and give us a close reading of William Butler Yeats's powerful Leda and the Swan. Professor and poet Ahmad Johnson will do a reading of his own sonnet, Leroy Eating Watermelon at Howard, and talk about sonnets from the 1960s and 70s as well. And Professor Lynn Keller will join us for a reading of Marilyn Hacker's graphic 20th century sonnet, Lesbian Ethics or Live Girl Girl Sex Acts.
Listener discretion is advised. Welcome one and all to University of the Air. Welcome back, Caroline Levine.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And in a greater interval, welcome back also a little later to Lynn Keller and welcome to Ahmad Johnson.
Thank you.
Pleasure to have you all with us. I seem to recall that William Butler Yeats was a poet who used a vast number of different verse forms. Was he partial to the sonnet, do you think?
He did. I would not say that he was partial to the sonnet. He chose it with very precise purposes in mind. So this 14-line form, you don't write it by accident. You write it thinking about a long tradition of people writing poetry and writing sonnets in particular. And I think in the early 20th century, you're still thinking, when Yeats was writing, you're still really thinking about the love sonnet as the major sonnet tradition. So poems like Elizabeth Barrett Browning's poem, which Emily read a couple of minutes ago, that's the kind of thing people are having in their minds when they're thinking about sonnets.
Can you tell us, just review really quickly, the two forms of the sonnet that came down to us and then what Yeats does with that?
Sure. So there are two main traditional forms of the sonnet, and then writers are always breaking the rules. So I'll tell you what the forms are, and then we can think about the breaks from the rules. The Petrarchan sonnet, which comes from the Italian poet Petrarch, is 14 lines broken into a section of 8 and a section of 6 lines, and that's the rhyme scheme that separates them. So the first 8 lines are two 4-line sections called quatrains that rhyme ABBA and CDDC, so they're kind of mirror images of each other. And then the last 6 lines are two groups of 3, so EFG, EFG. The Shakespearean sonnet, so-called, though Shakespeare didn't actually invent it, he just made it popular, is a little different. It's also 14 lines. It has 3 quatrains, so 3 of those ABBA sections, and then a couplet at the end, a closing 2-line rhyming pair. William Butler Yeats in Leda and the Swan chooses the Petrarchan form, and he sticks pretty close to it. But he does one really radical thing to it, or I would say two really radical things with it. He plays with the content of it, and when I read it, we'll see how it's not like the love sonnet that Elizabeth Barrett Browning was writing. But he also plays with the form. He breaks line 11 into two pieces. So it's a perfect Petrarchan sonnet, except that line 11 is on 2 different lines. And it's as though, as a modernist poet, he's trying to fracture the sonnet. He's trying to say it has to have a break in the middle.
Is that a typographical thing more than, I mean, why is that any different from a previous sonnet except for the typographical aspect of it?
Well, you know, it looks completely different on the page. It's actually not immediately recognizable as a sonnet because it looks like a modernist poem. It doesn't look perfectly organized and neat because this one line is jarringly different on the page. So you can't hear it. And that's a disadvantage of talking about this particular poem on the radio, though I hope that you'll follow along on the website. There's a link to the sonnet itself, as long as you're not driving.
Before we go any farther, why don't you read the poem? Because we want to hear it twice, so let's hear it for the first time.
Leda and the Swan. A sudden blow, the great wings beating still above the staggering girl, her thighs caressed by the dark webs, her nape caught in his bill. He holds her helpless, breast upon his breast. How can those terrified, vague fingers push the feathered glory from her loosening thighs? And how can body, laid in that white rush, but feel the strange heart beating where it lies? A shudder in the loins engenders there the broken wall, the burning roof and tower, and Agamemnon dead. Being so caught up, so mastered by the brute blood of the air, did she put on his knowledge with his power before the indifferent beak could let her drop?
Do you want to give us the mythological backstory?
Absolutely. So Yeats is drawing on the Greek myth of Leda and the Swan. He's taking a moment that we don't usually focus on. So it's a story where Zeus falls in love with a beautiful mortal woman named Leda, and he comes to her in the shape of a swan, in the form of a swan. As a result of their union, she gives birth to a daughter, Helen. And Helen is famously the most beautiful woman in the world. She marries a Greek man named Menelaus, and for a time they're happy, but she then runs off with a Trojan named Paris. And Menelaus, her husband, and his brother Agamemnon follow Helen, trying to take her back from Paris. And this is the start of the Trojan War. So it's the beginning of the 10-year war that is famously the subject of the two great Homeric epics, the Iliad and the Odyssey. So Yeats focuses on this very strange moment that, to my knowledge, is not of interest to any other writers or poets, which is the moment when Zeus, and here I think Yeats is very deliberate about saying he rapes Leda. It's a violent, very staggeringly graphic image of sex between a swan, a huge, divine, powerful swan, and a struggling, helpless girl.
The conception of Helen.
The conception of Helen, exactly. And it's that moment that starts this long, epic history.
And why do you think Yeats chose a sonnet for this subject matter? How is it in some way ironic to use, you know, the form of a sonnet to describe a rape by a swan?
Well, if we think about the sonnet as having a traditional focus on love, and particularly love for somebody who's sort of out of reach and feels, and that's the Petrarchan tradition in particular, feels unattainable, here you have the violent taking of what in previous sonnets the lover just kind of gazes at and longs for. Here, that lover is violent, he's all-powerful, and he is going to just take what he wants. And so part of what Yeats is doing is writing in a context where there's a lot of violence. So he's writing in the early 1920s, after the First World War, the war that was supposedly going to end all wars because it was so violent and so terrible. And he's also writing in the midst of the Irish struggle for independence from British rule. And so there's violence going on all around him. He's an Irishman. And he's saying the modern poem needs to take account of this violence, that the history of human relations is a history of violence. And so to sentimentalize it or to sanitize love is to miss the way that desire and love are bound up with these histories of terrible war and struggle.
And, well, that would certainly be in keeping with the fracture that we mentioned at the beginning that comes after that half line, and Agamemnon dead.
It's an amazing line, and Agamemnon dead. Readers have been kind of drawn to for generations because, to try to explain this quickly, and Agamemnon dead, the word and, which you don't usually pay any attention to, has three sounds in it, right? A, N, and D. Yeats repeats each of those sounds twice in the next three words. So and becomes aga in Memnon, N becomes the two N's in Memnon, and dead has the two D's. So and Agamemnon dead has this incredible kind of echo effect. And it's as though what Yeats is doing is saying in any given moment, like the rape of Leda, you can't see the incredible echoes or the after effects that will just follow. And so poetic sound is one way to carry off that echoing or reverberation through history.
And this is reducing, if you even want to use the word love in this context, to its most basic form. In fact, it's not even human. It's animal and human. And it's not going to have great repercussions. It's going to have great repercussions, but not pleasant ones.
Right. It's not going to fit gently into a tradition of thinking about human bodies coming together in some kind of ultimate union. I think Yeats is really interested in that strangeness of an animal body meeting a human body. So he gives us a lot of the nape and the bill and the webs of the swan and then the girl's heart and her thighs. And so we really have to picture the strangeness of these bodies coming together. And so, yes, it has huge repercussions, but it's not going to produce lots of sonnets in its wake that people can kind of enter into in an identifying
kind of way. Oh, boy, more animal people sonnets.
Yeah. Right.
Can you talk about the phrase white rush?
White rush.
How
can body laid in that white rush but feel the strange heart beating where it lies?
And then later where it's did she put on his knowledge with its power, it's as if this white rush, this contact, is more than just the physical or erotic. If it's did she put on his knowledge, there's something else here. If you have an encounter with the divine, because it is Zeus after all.
That's right. Happening. It's not just power. It's also divinity. It's also something greater than the human. And I think you're right. That phrase white rush suggests it's even beyond an embodied experience. It's kind of being taken over by something even transcendent. But then that last question, Yeats is famous for his rhetorical questions in his poetry. And I think the last question he asks in Leda and the Swan is particularly complicated and tough. So he says, did she put on his knowledge with his power before the indifferent beak could let her drop? It's almost perverse, the idea that she would be powerful in the moment that she's raped. What an incredibly powerless experience. But there is something about the fact that this moment launches the whole history of the Trojan War and the death of Agamemnon, and it's as though her being powerless has some power to produce historical events. And so the question won't resolve the relationship between power and powerlessness. And I think you could say the same about that sense of, is the moment of contact between Zeus and Leda a moment of union or not a moment of union? You know, what is that rush? Is it actually an experience of contact or is it just an experience of being carried away? And I don't think Yeats actually wants us to decide that very clearly or in any kind of settled way.
That's why he's asking it posing it as a question.
Yep. And he poses three questions in the sonnet, so it's not as though he has more questions than answers, we could say.
Can you read it again?
Sure. Leda and the Swan. A sudden blow, the great wings beating still above the staggering girl, her thighs caressed by the dark webs, her nape caught in his bill. He holds her helpless breast upon his breast. How can those terrified, vague fingers push the feathered glory from her loosening thighs? And how can body, laid in that white rush, but feel the strange heart beating where it lies? A shudder in the loins engenders there the broken wall, the burning roof and tower, and Agamemnon dead. Being so caught up, so mastered by the brute blood of the air, did she put on his knowledge with his power before the indifferent beak could let her drop?
It's a wonderful last line, too. Before the indifferent beak. I mean, okay, I'm through with you.
I'm through. Exactly. There's no love here in that sense of a lasting tie.
It's use.
This time I noticed that phrase, feathered glory. Again, that word glory or even the terrified. It's that sense of awe at something beyond the human. This ecstatic in the sense of being out of body.
And I think it's amazing that Yeats carries that off because if you try to think, if you're me and you're not a poet and you're trying to think about what sex between a swan and a person would look like, it's hard to give that majesty, I think, and terror. There's something not quite powerful in the sense that we usually think of in a swan. And so he's really working at that to try to give us that sense of awe and majesty and terror and power, despite the strangeness of it.
We think of swans as beautiful animals, and there is a strange beauty behind this indifferent power.
Yeah. One of the things I love about Yeats, he's a disturbing poet in many ways, and I think this is a disturbing poem. But he's always interested in the beauty that is in terror. And so he never quite leaves beauty behind. And so to think about how to put those two things together is kind of a quintessential 20th century and 21st century problem. So Yeats gets us started on this process of thinking through.
A terrible beauty is born, I think he wrote in
exactly.
Easter Rising. We're going to look at the sonnet in the later part of the 20th century when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Leroy eating watermelon at Howard. Better dead. Better to dig up and foul poor Booker's bones or pluck the pearled buttons from the good doctor's waistcoat than undo all that fine book learning. What rancor, boy, what black and wooden alchemy would bring you into the clear light, seed spitting, meat, juice smattered about your mouth and neck. Better to petition fools. Better doxologize a devil even than abandon the good sense God gave a chimp. This here is the whole caboodle, capstone of Negro education, and you, collar undone, hair in pot hooks, teeth damn near gnashing the rind. Son, I aim to write down your name.
That's the sonnet, Leroy Eating Watermelon at Howard, by Ahmad Johnson. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guests this hour, Caroline Levine, Ahmad Johnson, and Lynn Keller, as we continue our two-part discussion of the history of English literature through the sonnet. Now we have a real luxury. We have someone who is a poet and a professor who wrote a sonnet, and therefore, if we have any questions, we can ask you, what did you mean in that line? But let's start, Ahmad. Can you tell us about what led to your writing the sonnet and what the sonnet form means to you as a poet?
Great sonnet, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Well, I've always felt a great deal of anxiety about the sonnet tradition, and that's partly connected to not quite understanding what I would hope to perform in terms of writing a sonnet. The poem, Leroy Eating Watermelon at Howard, refers to Leroy Jones, who was also known as, or was also known as Miriam Baraka. And part of the impulse behind this poem really speaks to that anxiety that Jones understood, an anxiety connected to the politics of uplift, or what it means to think about our performative selves. There are ways in which sometimes I contemplate a figure, a poet like Phyllis Wheatley. And thinking about Phyllis Wheatley as a neoclassical poet, put in a position to essentially perform her humanity. And there are ways in which I think my anxiety toward the sonnet was in some ways connected to that ambiguity in terms of how I might be perceived in terms of a participation in the sonnet tradition. So this poem speaks to that anxiety a bit.
Well, Phyllis Wheatley had to write a poem on the spot to prove that she could actually do it as a slave poet, to sort of show John Hancock and others that she was who she said. With the sonnet, is the anxiety about fitting into this sort of prescribed rhyme pattern and meter and following in a tradition that has all these expectations?
Well, moving into the 20th century, I mean, we are talking about a great deal of political change and upheaval. In the context of literary tradition, as a poet, sometimes it's tricky to think about how I would place myself within a particular literary tradition. You know, thinking about myself historically is somewhat complicated. But at the same time, I think the pursuit of poetry is thinking about that continuum, the way we internalize particular voices, particular rhythms, and then make choices in terms of where and how we enter that tradition.
Do you feel at all concerned about having references in there that 10, 20, 30 years from now might have to be explained? I see, this critical edition of your works with the footnotes down here explaining, well, whose waistcoat would that be and who's the doctor, for example?
And this is important in terms of how we understand literary tradition and particular references. We wouldn't need that in a discussion of Agamemnon, for instance. But the pairing of Booker, for instance, and the doctor would refer to Booker T. Washington and Dr. W.B. Du Bois, the ways in which this poem is coded in terms of African-American history does assume a certain responsibility for the reader to have internalized some of that work to be able to code it. Not that I'm interested in riddles, but I'm imagining a particular audience, which also kind of flips the coin in terms of how we participate in art.
Can you do me a favor and take this poem line by line, sort of break it down and tell us what you had in mind?
Oh, sure. This poem refers to a moment in Amir Baraka's life. Amir Baraka is a master myth maker. You know, one of the preeminent professors at Howard University, actually graduated from Howard University, so this is also connected to a personal kind of literary tradition. Sterling Brown is a longtime professor at Howard. He used to invite students into his office and say, let's sit around and tell some lies. And this was a part of how he understood literary production in terms of play. I think Baraka took that to heart in this episode. This is an episode that we call the episode of the watermelon. And Baraka likes to explain that one afternoon he's sitting in front of the administration building eating a slice of watermelon. And to understand the history of Howard University, it was founded by the Freedmen's Bureau in 1867 with this idea of upliftment, former slaves being educated, kind of entering the workforce. And Baraka is kind of poking fun at that concept, the politics of uplift, the image of a young African-American male sitting on a curb eating a slice of watermelon is obviously connected to the derogatory images of African-Americans during the post-Reconstruction era. So an administrator sees Baraka with this slice of watermelon and confronts him. If I can curse a little bit, what the hell are you doing? This is the capstone of Negro education. You're embarrassing yourself. So Baraka explains, and this is kind of the dawn of his political awareness, tosses the watermelon rind at the administrator and storms off. And this becomes the beginning of his activist career and his artistic career. So this poem is written from the perspective of that administrator, just thinking about that tension in terms of the politics of the past and the politics of the future, the dawn of the Black Arts Movement, if we can think of it that way. So structurally, better dead, better to dig up and foul poor Booker's bones. That first gesture refers to Booker T. Washington and is thinking about the politics of uplift, what it means for African Americans to, as Booker T. Washington would say, to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, right? Better to dig up and foul poor Booker's bones or pluck the pearled buttons from the good doctor's waistcoat. There is a fairly classic conflict between Booker T. Washington and W. E. Du Bois in terms of the way African Americans would identify uplift. Is it uplift in terms of pursuits in business, or is it uplift in terms of the arts? It seems perfect in some ways to think of those pearled buttons being connected to W. E. Du Bois' waistcoat.
Great image. Mm-hmm.
So the poem itself is way of engaging history, but it's also a performance of that administrator's voice and thinking about what's precarious in terms of how he sees his own identity. So we have these shifts in diction, what ranker boy, what black and wooden alchemy.
And that word boy is a little bit of a flashpoint, isn't it?
Absolutely. Part of it is power dynamic, ways in which the administrator is putting down the student to kind of, again, the idea of the precarious nature of what it means to be an intellectual, what it means to perform a particular tradition. Baraka at this moment is completely eschewing this. We think about the nature of the Black Arts Movement is essentially an attempt to identify what Baraka called a blues people, a low culture, a culture that isn't necessarily connected to these kind of middle class aspirations, but they're still artistic vitality there, and to see that as the core essence, the essential element of a black aesthetic. So this conflict is really the beginning of that. What does it mean to commit an act of self-sabotage, right? Eating the slice of watermelon is essentially that. But in the process, Baraka is really beginning to articulate something very complicated that completely shifted how we understand African-American poetry, in the latter part of the 20th century.
And then what black and wooden alchemy, what an interesting choice.
And even that, part of what's at play here is thinking about the administrator beginning to use terms that would speak to the dawn of the Black Arts Movement, Black alchemy, Black arts, you know, the idea of a kind of inversion, you know, everything that would be considered foul and evil that would be synonymous with the term black is then beautiful, right? And
why
this is
wouldn't?
A thing that he can't understand completely. Yeah.
Why wouldn't? You say black and wooden. Alchemy.
Oh, well, wooden in that sense of, you know, being dense, right? And that sense of something being dated. So a kind of play in terms of that political understanding that the administrator can't quite grasp, but then he is essentially giving Baraka the language that would shift the artistic moment. And there, the constant play in terms of language, I mean, thinking about this as a sonnet, it seemed completely appropriate for the administrator to speak in a voice that would be connected to the sonnet tradition. I'm not sure if I could sit down on my own and write in the first person and use the sonnet because I would be – I just feel a little anxiety in terms of what I was performing. So there are ways in which the tradition of the sonnet seem dated, and there's something kind of comic, like the idea of parody ultimately connected to that.
Well, and I suppose an administrator likes to put things in boxes, likes to put things, you know, sort of in a rigid form, and Baraka's not fitting what he wants him to fit. So, but the sonnet would suggest structure, trying to get something in order perhaps.
And even with that, it's precarious that shifts in diction also represent these cracks in terms of how completely dedicated the administrator is to this concept, you know, this tradition.
This isn't just a matter of eating watermelon, though. This guy has really made a mess of it, hasn't he? I mean, juice smattered about your mouth and neck. He's really flaunting this uplift concept.
Well, and that's, I think, if you go after something, you have to do it wholeheartedly. And, you know, imagining Baraka in that moment has always tickled me.
Can you talk about your line when you talk about when you have the administrator say that he's abandoning the good sense God gave a chimp?
Well, there are all these parallels in this poem. There's a great deal of repetition. Better dead, better to dig up. What rancor boy, what black and wooden alchemy. I'm very interested in, structurally, rather than think about rhyme being in rhyme, internal rhyme, and also image rhyme, a rhyme in terms of syntactical structures. So what rancor boy is that first kind of dig in terms of, you know, a kind of, you know, pejorative reference. That idea of the good sense God gave a chimp is then an extension of that in terms of if you didn't get it the first time with the administrator calling him boy, now he's referring to him as a monkey. Right? Now this feeds into, you know, the derogatory language, the conceptual work that makes that administrator complicated in terms of what he represents as a mentor. These are two black men speaking to each other. It's an in-house conversation. So then even with that, there's still this echo of, you know, the larger cultural concerns that make their interaction that much more complicated.
In our previous hour talking about sonnets, I mentioned we got into this topic of George Meredith and how conversational his 16-line sonnets tended to be. And you've done much the same thing here, very much the same, in fact, to get this conversational effect, a lot of run-on lines. And then you have this conversational phrase, this here is the whole caboodle, which is probably the first time the word caboodle has ever appeared in a sonnet.
That might be. I think that's part of the aim is to figure out what phrase I could work into a sonnet and completely transform the tradition. Now there's, you know, before the caboodle reference and after in terms of how we think about literary tradition in the sonnet.
Well, and it's a funny juxtaposition because you've got this here is the whole caboodle, capstone of Negro education. So you've got the sort of traditional notion of education right next to caboodle.
Well, in that sense, it's connected to the diction shifts that play in terms of what it means for African Americans to code switch, how that speaks to a certain kind of intimacy. The role of the administrator is complicated because he represents authority. He represents projection in terms of, you know, an imagined future, you know, for African Americans. And now he's confronted with someone who completely rejects that. So he's trying to find the language to communicate to him, and it's constantly kind of tumbling, constantly failing. You know, that music in terms of the alliteration and assonance also layers the poem in terms of how it kind of stumbles forward.
I like the way he's damn near gnashing the rind, too. It kind of reminds me of that line of Thoreau's about he wanted to suck out the marrow of life. You know, he wanted to get even the part that people don't usually eat.
Mm-hmm. again, that idea of the act of self-sabotage, you know, what it means to kind of, you know, completely work to undermine any sense of bourgeois sensibility.
And then there is a, at least I take it as a little contrast with that word boy, because here, and it's in caps too, son, which although it's a kind of, in a way, a sort of a threatening address, on the other hand, it's implies a sort of a taking under the wing too.
Well, and I think that speaks to that anxiety. I'm trying to speak to you. I'm trying to communicate to you, son. But at the same time, he is writing down his name, right? Ironically, Leroy Jones changes his name to Amir Baraka. So the idea of remembering him in that way is totally erased and becomes irrelevant in terms of personal transformation.
You may not have intended this. It's always fun to guess what authors intend and what they don't. But since you're here, we can ask you. I aim to write down your name. That is exactly the kind of thing that Shakespeare is saying at the end of his son. You know, this gives life to thee. I'm writing down your name.
Well, and in that sense, there's this constant play in terms of the sonnet tradition. Like structurally, this moves in the same way we would think of a Petrarchan sonnet. You know, there's an octave and a sestet. That question mark kind of in the belly of the poem, juice smattering about your mouth and neck. Question mark is kind of the first hard stop if you think about the way the poem moves. So structurally, it's still balanced in the way we might think of a traditional sonnet. But then I'm also interested in what it means to kind of manipulate the different echoes in terms of how we understand the sonnet tradition. So, son, I aim to write down your name. And that's the first moment where we have a very kind of, you know, clear and even rhyme. It kind of mimics the rhyming couplet that mm-hmm. we would have at the end of a Shakespearean sonnet. So part of it is to take the sonnet tradition and turn it inside out, that there's still echoes. It's still 14 lines. There's still a presence of a volta, but the pressure is kind of taken off the end rhyme. You know, all the rhyme is internal for the most part. So the way it moves is completely different. So there's still that concept. There's still that image there, but then there's an opportunity for play. I think that's part of what's exciting about writing sonnets now is there's certain things that we can do, but we're not wedded to them in terms of what it means to write a successful sonnet versus something that fails. That's not really a question.
And let's hear you read it again.
Sure. Leroy eating watermelon at Howard. Better dead. Better to dig up and foul poor Booker's bones or pluck the pearled buttons from the good doctor's waistcoat, then undo all that fine book learning. What rancor, boy, what black and wooden alchemy would bring you into the clear light, seed spitting, meat, juice smattered about your mouth and neck? Better to petition fools. Better doxologize a devil even than abandon the good sense God gave a chimp. This here is the whole caboodle, capstone of Negro education, and you, collar undone, hair in pot hooks, teeth damn near gnashing the rind. Son, I aim to write down your name.
A couple other little contrasts you had in there that I liked too. One was better to doxologize the devil. I mean, that starts to sound like Emily Dickinson there, you know. And then the contrast between the doctor's buttons on his waistcoat and your collar is undone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the idea of completely freeing oneself from that tradition. And even certain things like your hair and pot hooks, right?
Yes.
We think of kind of the traditional pot hook, but that's also a term in calligraphy in terms of the kind of curlicue that would happen at the end of a character. So just that absurd concept in terms of you know, something being a flourish and then what that means in the nature of Baraka's creative inspiration.
I mean, when did you write this poem?
I wrote this about a year ago, so it was published in the spring of last year in the Indiana Review.
So if anybody needs a gloss, you know, you can get it from us right here.
Planning to write more sonnets?
I am. I it would be interesting to write a sonnet that wouldn't be a parody. I often think when I'm interested in sonnets that it's playful. A group of us, in honor of Elizabeth Alexander, who read a poem during the inauguration for Obama, a group of us got together and wrote a cover poems, for one of her poems, essentially taking the language and manipulating it, mm-hmm. and kind of pairing it. There was this poem refers to a woman who's dressed up as an Aunt Jemima, like in Macy's in the 50s. And I decided to take one of the holy sonnets and kind of manipulate that. So the first line, and it's a sonnet, but the first line is, "Batter my heart, three pancake girl." So sonnets
sure
usually move
been butter my heart, three pancake girl.
We are going to be back in a moment with more on the sonnet tradition. Back in the moment with University of the Year.
Lesbian ethics or live girl-girl sex acts. It's not that I'm inimical to sleaze. I most fondly remember getting it on with her, crammed standing in an airplane John, air sprayed, spot lit, jeans bunched around our knees, or in the Fiat, under some chestnut trees, in full view of the lunchbound routier, with her. Girl, I would have you anyway or where, except that infidelity's the kind of bad taste that leaves a bad taste worse than the mouse breath of a hangover. I want you so much I can taste it. But that's not the taste I want, though it means wasting precocious spring waiting on hold in rut for clean time to be your low-minded lover.
A sonnet by Marilyn Hecker, which takes us into the 20th century in our survey of English literature through sonnets. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guests for this hour, Carolyn Levine, Armand Johnson, and Lynn Keller, who read that poem. Well, we have come just about as far as we can from that original concept of the love in a sonnet being unattainable and idealized. This is very attainable, very less than ideal, and all of this said in the sonnet.
Yes, that is one of the really distinctive differences of this work by Marilyn Hecker, a contemporary lesbian writer who I think wants to critique that notion of the beloved at a distance, the beloved as object. And so here, this poem is part of a book-length sequence of sonnets. And it's, in some ways, of all the sonnets that we've talked about, the closest to the Shakespearean model in its conception, the whole book-length sequence that traces a love relationship. But it's also, precisely because of those strong parallels, it enables a powerful rethinking of some of the problematics of that largely patriarchal tradition in which, as one characteristic, is that the male gaze on the female poet who is unobtainable. Actually, in this particular poem, the beloved is still unobtainable for reasons, however, of the speaker's choosing, and that seems very important.
Can you talk about the title? It's a, you know, for a sonnet, it's a very striking title, Lesbian Ethics or Live Girl-Girl Sex Acts.
Right. The title has two parts, and I think they mirror or suggest for us an important tension in the poem, because I do think this is a poem about ethics and a poem that rejects aspects of the ethics of the traditional sonnet sequence or of the tradition of love poetry, perhaps, that it represents. This is a poem that says, I want you so much, but I'm not going to have you in a way that I conceive of as unethical. And that is, this is the fourth poem in a book-length sequence that has more than 200 sonnets in it. So this is very early in this budding relationship. And it's a relationship, interestingly, between a somewhat older woman, she's in her 40s, and a very young woman, so that the sequence has as its epigraph a Shakespearean sonnet, "That time of year thou mayst in me behold," which is spoken by someone who represents himself as being in the autumn of his life and is saying to his lover, really appreciate me while you have me because I won't be around here for very long. So this too is what we might call a May-January love relationship. And at this point, the young beloved woman is still living with someone else. And to seduce her or to just to have sex with her would be a betrayal of an important relationship that the speaker wants to respect, the relationship between these two women. So when we think of the male tradition of love poetry, it's often a tradition used to seduce, to say life is short.
Sure, Andrew Marvell.
Andrew Marvell would be definitely the sort of prime example of that.
Gather your rosebuds and
Donna
all that.
Also. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And even something like that, the Shakespeare sonnet with which we opened, where the idea is, come be my lover and I'll make you immortal, right? So there, you know. So even that is a kind of seduction strategy. But here she is being ethical in saying, I refuse to participate in that kind of seduction. So that's the lesbian ethics part of the title, I think. The live girl-girl sex acts sounds like something you'd see posted outside a club, right? And the other part of this is, the other part of this poem is saying, I like sleaze, and I value a hedonistic appreciation for sexuality that does not allow itself to be cowed by standards of what's proper that have nothing to do with real ethics, just with prudery or prejudice. And so she's flaunting in her title what she also flaunts in the poem itself, saying, yeah, I've had sex in places that you would think are really inappropriate, but what I care about isn't that. It's those real important ethics about who's hurt or not hurt, who's respected or not respected. And, you know, she celebrates having had, you know, had sex in the airport, John, you know, which is really carrying it pretty far.
Yeah, I was just thinking, you can't get, I mean, if you think about, you know, sonnet and the idea of elevation and celebrating something that's grand and so on, an airplane, John, just is such a, I know, unpleasant and claustrophobic place to be.
It is. And so this is a really saying our passion is really powerful. If we can get by the nasty smell of that stuff they put to mask the odors in there and, you know, and mm-hmm. how cramped and crowded this is and the plane is lurching and, oh, my God, yeah. It sounds awful, right? But not if you're really, you know, if you're just so passionate and free that those things are not important to you.
And the rhyme seems to be kind of comic with the getting it on and the Johnny. I mean, you hear those rhymes and that's part of what seems almost comic at that point to use the
Absolutely.
Sonnet form
Absolutely.
In that way.
So Marilyn Hacker is someone who's actually very consistently a formalist. The 20th century is not a century that's really invested predominantly in traditional rhymed and, you know, poems with regular schemes of rhyme and meter. We think of 20th century poetry as predominantly poetry that's in free verse or highly disjunctive collage forms. But there has been always an ongoing tradition of formalist writing, despite that norm, so that we can think back to Edna St. Vincent Millay, back to Robert Frost, back to W.H. Auden, on through the mid-century into writers like James Merrill, a very committed and incredibly skillful formalist, and Marilyn Hacker, and on to Imaud Johnson. But Marilyn Hacker is, as I say, very consistently a formalist, and she is very aware of sort of performing within this in the ways that Imaud talked about. We might not think of the sonnet sequence as primarily the possession of women, and certainly not primarily the possession of lesbian women, so that there's perhaps an ambivalence in claiming it and a desire, therefore, to self-consciously perform participation in something in order to show, I can do this. I can mm-hmm. play this game. I can play it so well. And I don't have to play entirely by the rules, so that the language that she uses, like Imaud's caboodle, is, you know, she's going to put some slang in here, right? She's going to talk about getting it on. This is probably, you know, again, this is not the phrase that appears in the sonnet tradition. At the same time that she's capable of throwing out a little French or using words like inimical or, you know, there's plenty of polysyllabic, sophisticated language in here. And this is part of her performing her capability within something that one might expect her to have some ambivalence about claiming. So it's a distancing, not just the distancing that is the sonnet itself, as we've talked about, or characteristic of the sonnet, but a distancing from the tradition of the sonnet.
It occurred to me, too, that, you know, we opened the hour with a reading from 19th century Elizabeth Barrett Browning's poem, How Do I Love Thee, Let Me Count the Ways, which, although it's very traditional, it's actually Barrett Browning talking about her feelings, not about the the male object, but, you know, let me tell you about how I love you. And it's really about her feelings. This one, the speaker also, it's about, you know, let me tell you how much I want you, and let me tell you how I can taste it. It's, we don't learn too much about the subject of this sonnet, right?
About, you mean
the other woman.
Yes.
Learn more about the,
in this
the
whole collection, she's very careful not to, for instance, spend time describing the beauty of the beloved, which would be something that would be characteristic of the patriarchal tradition of the sonnet. And she even has the beloved here is also a poet, and there's a lot of talk about that person's being someone who can also express herself in writing, even though there isn't the other half of the, you know, we don't hear her sonnets. Although there is at least one poem that is written in her own, the beloved's voice. And in it, she is very strongly objecting to being made an object and sort of cautioning her lover not to do that. So there, I think there's a very deliberate attempt to get over some of these, as I say, problems in the sonnet that involve a kind of objectification of the beloved.
And what does Marilyn Hacker do with the forms that we've been talking about? I mean, I hear the rhymes, the taste and the waist and the sleeves and the knees and so on. What does she do with the Shakespearean and Petrarchan forms?
This one is very close to a Petrarchan form. I guess instead of the EFG, EFG, she does EFGEGF or something like that.
You have to do something different, right?
But it is very close, although she also does things like something that listeners won't be able to hear is that she actually breaks a line mid-word, that the word wasting, the first syllable waste appears on one line and then the ing appears on another. So this is one of those examples of just flaunting the form and making clear that the sonnet is an artifice. This is not natural, and it is a game that we play, or it is an elaborate puzzle that a skillful poet can put together. So she fits the form, and she also is really outrageous in the way in which she does it.
And can you read it again?
Absolutely. Lesbian ethics, or live girl-girl sex acts. It's not that I'm inimical to sleaze. I most fondly remember getting it on with her, crammed standing in an airplane john, air sprayed, spot lit, jeans bunched around our knees, or in the Fiat under some chestnut trees in full view of the lunchbound routier. With her, girl, I would have you anyway or where, except that infidelity's the kind of bad taste that leaves a bad taste worse than the mouse breath of a hangover. I want you so much I can taste it, but that's not the taste I want, though it means wasting precocious spring, waiting on hold in rut for clean time to be your low-minded lover. You know, something that strikes me as I read it again is how much we are returned to the Shakespearean wordplay and her exploration of the different notions of taste here, rather like what Mike Whitmore talked about with the I person, I, me, and the eye, the visual organ, the organ of sight. So here we have the taste as in what is on the tongue in a poem that's very much about celebrating sensory experience, but also taste in the sense of recognizing what is appropriate, having good taste in a fundamentally, here, a fundamentally ethical sense that she's playing on, or even to invoke in the last line, clean time to be your low-minded lover, because many people might regard as dirty, not clean, what she describes shamelessly, what she's proud to claim as sexual behavior that she's enjoyed in the past with a previous lover and which she hopes to enjoy in the future with this lover or this lover-to-be, because this would be still an unconsummated relationship. So clean works against the implied dirty and against the sleaze, the word sleaze. So there's a lot of wordplay in the Shakespearean mold.
What occurs to me is how flexible the sonnet form is, whether we go with a Shakespeare sonnet from the Renaissance or all the way up to last year with a sonnet by Ahmad Johnson. I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, thanking our guests for this hour, Caroline Levine, Ahmad Johnson, and Lynn Keller. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And you'll find copies of the sonnets online. There's a link on our website. Back next week with more University of the Year.
Next Sunday afternoon at 4, during University of the Year, we look at the life and poetry of Ezra Pound, a remarkable American whose life took him from the Idaho Territory in the 1880s to a kind of banishment in Italy during World War II. Join us here on Wisconsin Public Radio.